This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
This is the BBC.
Welcome to the briefing room with me, David Aronovich. You open the auditory door, you come on in, and you find out what's going on in the world. And do please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. And if you'd like, please recommend us to your friends, enemies, anyone really. And a thanks to those of you who've recently reviewed us, including Xanderall, Don Scott, Trofimov Anglais, Moore's Tours and Patrick Firstad. And do please keep them coming. If you enjoy this, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room. But in this edition, I'm getting briefed on whether you'd be willing to pay more to fund the NHS. Last April, The Briefing Room looked at the long-term funding of the NHS in England. This is where we ended up.
We got two choices. We could either respond to that desire to spend more money, and that will cost us, and we'll have to maybe put up taxes. Or we don't respond to that. We simply say, well, we'll just live with the money we've got. The calculation for the public is, are we willing to give up on some of our disposable income and pay a bit more tax? Or we want to keep our money in our pockets, but we'll get what we pay for.
That was John Appleby, chief economist at the Nuffield Trust. 9 months was enough time to gestate the next crisis. This week, the leader of the opposition went at it hammer.
Will the Prime Minister assure patients that in 2018, less NHS money intended for patient care will be feathering the nests of shareholders in private health companies?
And the Prime Minister responded tongs.
Under which government was it that private access and private use of private sector in the health service increased? No, it wasn't.
Some non-partisan observers felt it was like Milton's Paradise Lost. No light, but rather darkness visible. Neither answered John Appleby's point. But why? When will or can any political party level with the voters and tell us how much more we're going to have to pay to fund the NHS so that it is the service we demand it should be? Step into the briefing room to find out. First into the briefing room to take us through the recent history of NHS funding is Anita Charlesworth of the Health Foundation, a charity which analyses health policy.
In 2010, the NHS was coming out of a decade of transformation in its funding, resources and performance. Spending on our NHS over that decade had increased by an average of 6% a year over and above inflation. What that meant was that the number of nurses employed in the NHS had increased by a quarter. Waiting times fell sharply. In 2000, on average, people waited 3 months for an operation in England. By 2010, that had fallen to 1 month. So in the 2010 election, we were faced with a public sector deficit of 10% of our GDP. All of the political parties were committed to reducing that deficit. The Conservatives were committed to abolishing it by 2015. Both Labour and the Conservatives, though, had promised that within those spending cuts, the NHS would be protected, but neither were promising significant increases.
It is only three letters long, but in its letters lie the hopes of millions of people in our country, the NHS. I'll cut the deficit, not the NHS.
After the Conservatives were elected in 2010 and formed the coalition, they did protect the NHS. They also introduced substantial reforms and funding grew by around 1% a year above inflation. But it has to be seen against pressures on the NHS from a growing and ageing population, which meant that you would expect funding to grow by 4% a year. The government sought to bridge that gap between low funding growth and increasing pressures by a mixture of one-off initiatives such as holding down pay, cutting administrative costs. But those changes were one-off. They were predicated on the deficit being eliminated in the Parliament. The deficit wasn't eliminated by 2015. Many of the measures they took in the short term undermined long-term efficiency. So one of the things that they did was to reduce the number of nurse training places. But what it meant was that by 2015, we had big shortages of nurses and we were having to pay expensive agency staff to come in and fill those gaps. By 2015, we're really seeing a turning point in the NHS's ability to cope with this prolonged period of austerity. We start to see increases in the number of patients who are in hospital, medically fit to go home, but who can't go home because the social care support that they would need is not there. So we see waiting times increase both for accident emergency and for hospitals. And critically, the majority of NHS hospitals by this time can't balance their books. NHS England, which is the body that oversees the NHS, had a new chief executive, Simon Stevens. And one of the first things that he did was spend 6 months setting out a new vision for the NHS over a five-year period, much more emphasis on health prevention, on early diagnosis, on GPs, community nurses, mental health services, all working collaboratively together. Jeremy Hunt, the Secretary of State for Health, backed the five-year forward view.
Well, we will give whatever they need. It might be more than 8 billion, it might be less. If it needs 8 billion, we'll find that. If it needs more than 8 billion, we'll find that. If it needs less than 8 billion, we'll find that. But we're backing the plan.
So in 2015, all the political parties were promising more money for the NHS. The Conservatives reinterpreted the definition of NHS spending and committed to $8 billion for frontline services, but took a lot of that funding from the wider NHS budget, from capital investment, from investment in training, and from the public health budget, where Simon Stevens had very clearly said, we need $8 billion and good population health support and social care. By 2017, it's clear that the financial squeeze on the NHS is really starting to have an impact on the service's performance. In the 2017 general election, all of the political parties were committed to real terms increases in the funding for the NHS. But those funding increases fell well short of the 4% a year, which most independent experts identify would be needed to meet growing needs on our systems. So the Labour Party's proposals would have left the NHS with a funding gap of £17 billion in 2022, whereas the Conservatives would have left the NHS with a funding gap of around £22 billion. Alongside funding, we hear Jeremy Corbyn focus a lot on privatisation in the NHS and the role of the private sector.
We are ready to step in and save the NHS from the cuts and privatisation that have happened over the past 7 years. The privatisation has gone on a huge scale. £13 billion of taxpayers' money handed over the last year to private companies to profit from our NHS services.
So it is around 7.5% of the NHS budget that goes on care provided in private hospitals. That compares to just under 3% of the NHS budget back in 2006. There was a big increase in the role of the private sector under the Labour government between 2006 and 2010. That increase has continued, but actually in some areas has begun to stabilise in recent years. There's been no big expansion in the number of private hospitals in the system. So if you wanted to reverse, as Labour has talked about, the role of the private sector in the NHS, you actually need to put in place the capacity in terms of buildings and, most critically, nurses and doctors to be able to provide that care in the NHS.
Anita Charlesworth on the absence of easy answers. But difficult answers may depend on what public opinion and the voters will support. Dan Wellings is a senior policy fellow at the King's Fund, a health and social policy think tank. He has carried out research on what the public thinks.
So start with the attitude towards the NHS, and I think over the last year we've started to see increasing levels of concern, particularly for the future of the NHS. And when you start to drill down into what is driving that concern, you can see it's the messages around funding and the lack of funding that people think the service is now getting. And you can see at least 80% of people are now saying there's a major or severe funding issue with the NHS. Broadly on the patient experience surveys, you see the services holding up fairly well.
So people are saying, I'm relatively happy with the NHS in terms of my experience of it, but I'm increasingly worried about it.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And if you look at concern over the next 5 years, you've got the record level of pessimism for what's going to happen to it. So over 62% of people are saying, actually, it's going to get worse over the next 5 years, and only 15% saying it's going to get better.
How does that compare with attitudes going back?
Well, that's at record levels from 2002 when that question was first asked. And actually, it's far higher than pessimism for other public services. And I think one of the things is that the NHS, as we know, even within public services, is the institution that people feel the strongest emotional attachment to. One in two people say it's the thing that makes them proudest to be British. And it's this institution that for 70 years we've lived with through life and death, and it's still there. It's this resonance with that institution.
So it has a value in itself, and it also has a symbolic value, and it has a level of attachment which is not matched by any other institution in terms of polling.
Well, one of the questions with the 70th birthday coming up in July, we were interested in seeing, well, look, there are founding principles, you know, free at the point of need, comprehensive and primarily funded through taxation. And we were interested to find out from the public, do those still apply? Are they still relevant today? And actually we find that 9 out of 10 people think all of those principles should still apply to the NHS today, 70 years on.
So pessimism about the future of the NHS is not matched by dwindling support for the basis on which the NHS was formed and funded.
What people don't look for is a change in the funding model. That's not the answer that people see as the issue. There's a question of, you know, taxation, would people pay more? But actually, they don't start to think, well, we should fund it differently or we should pay for it differently. That still holds as true as it's ever done.
Right, that's very interesting. So let's now talk about precisely that question of whether or not people would be prepared to pay more in order to fund the NHS. Take us through how you ask that question, what results you get and how that's developed.
For people that ask these types of questions, it's one of the most difficult questions you can ask, because how do you frame that question? But it's been asked in a number of ways over the last year in various different polls and surveys. And what we're seeing across all of them is an increasing acceptance or a willingness to start thinking about paying more tax, whether that be through national insurance, and we can discuss that. Is it a more dedicated NHS tax or is it around paying more income tax? One of the challenges is often with these types of surveys, you can ask people, do you think taxes should increase? And people will say yes, but they don't mean theirs. So in the last survey we did, we actually did what we call a split sample. So we took 1,000 people, we asked 500 one way, which is a sort of more generic about increasing taxes, and we asked 500 people saying, would you personally be willing to pay taxes? And for both of those questions, the answer was 2/3 of people would say they would.
So there was no difference?
There was a 4% increase in the number of people that said they would be personally willing. Now, I'll caveat that with it's still not statistically significant, but broadly there's no difference between the answers.
Now, if you were a politician, would you believe them?
I think it's difficult. There is precedent set here. I think it's a fair challenge to say, well, what you say in a survey and what you do in the voting booth is a different thing. But if you look back at 2002, when Gordon Brown increased national insurance, which you could say is starting to think about a dedicated tax towards the NHS, it was certainly messaged that way at the time. Actually, after that budget in 2002, with a £40 billion injection into the NHS, you saw 76% approval. And even amongst Conservatives at the time, I think there was roughly a 54% approval for that budget.
Dan Wellings, is there now a way to make the public happier about the cold reality, rather than just the warm idea, of paying more taxes? In recent weeks, there's been renewed talk of a hypothecated or dedicated tax to fund the NHS. Sir Julian Legrand is Professor of Social Policy at the London School of Economics and a former policy adviser to Tony Blair. He was in the briefing room earlier to explain what a hypothecated tax would involve.
It means an earmarked tax, or a tax where the revenue that's raised from the tax is earmarked for one particular use.
OK, so explain to me how a hypothecated tax might be used in the case of health.
Well, you had a tax, let's say a form of income tax. You tax all income, like the present income tax. But you have it alongside that, and only the revenue from that tax is used to pay for the National Health Service, maybe for social care as well. I think most of the people who think that such a tax is a good idea would want it to fund social care and health care simultaneously.
So you'd have something, you pay your income tax, but you'd also have something called health tax, and that would show up in your PAYE and so on.
Yes, that's exactly what would happen, yes. It might be a little like national insurance. I mean, national insurance tax is rather similar, except national insurance is only levied upon income from work. This would be a tax, I think, across all forms of income, including capital income from capital.
And it would be set in exactly the same way as other income taxes. In other words, levied each year in the same way by the government, varying from year to year.
Yes, it would. Yes, it would be set in the budget each year. They would say how much it's likely to be. And preferably, I think most people who advocate this idea would actually like the tax rate to remain the same year upon year. Which actually creates problems because, of course, if the economy goes down, then the revenue will go down. If the economy goes up, then the revenue will go up. You probably need some kind of stabilisation fund where actually, in good times, the money goes into that and in bad times, the money comes out of that in order to keep the health service and social care going.
Well, why do you think that the idea is gaining a lot of currency now? People are talking about it a lot right now.
I think everybody is reasonably convinced that the NHS needs more money. But I think people are increasingly convinced that social care needs more money. I mean, many of the problems about the NHS are arising because people can't be discharged from hospital and looked after afterwards. Again, most people think, too, that social care probably ought to be free, like healthcare is free. After all, if we care for people with cancer, why shouldn't we be caring for people with Alzheimer's on the same basis and basically free at the point of use? So, and now, of course, both of those things require a lot of money, both free healthcare and free social care. And people think that actually, if you try and fund it out of general taxation, the resistance to the general taxation will be so great that you won't be able to do it. So people are thinking, well, let's go for an earmarked tax, because people will be more inclined to pay that if they know where the money is going.
So it is a way of getting people to cough up more tax without objecting to it.
I put crudely, yes, that's exactly what it is, yes. And it's not wholly unreasonable. I mean, actually, people do complain about paying taxes. Everybody complains about paying taxes. We all complain about paying taxes. However, they complain less if they know where the money is going. Many people seem to think when you pay taxes, it just goes in a kind of black hole. Now, if they actually know where the money is going, then people are much more prepared to pay taxes for that service.
Sir Julian Legrand. Increased taxation, but how much? A hypothecated tax, but would it work? And what will happen if we don't find a way of getting quite a lot of extra money year after year after year? Joining me in the briefing room are Sally Gainsbury, Senior Policy Advisor from the Nuffield Trust, and Newsnight's policy editor, Chris Cook.
Well, the NHS really is in a pretty poor financial state at the moment. Hospitals and other NHS providers last financial year ended the year in deficit by around about £4 billion in underlying terms. They look set to end the current financial year in a very similar position. This year alone, they have been asked by their main regulator to find £3.7 billion of savings. This is equivalent to, you know, well over 4% of their operating costs.
What things are they actually doing to try and keep costs down?
The baseline that all hospitals are having to do is to absorb any costs of inflation. So that's when their clinical supplies or, you know, their catering supplies, etc., or their fuel supplies. Obviously, these things go up in line with inflation. So the first port of call is to absorb the cost of inflation, obviously the administration and overhead costs, but also to find more efficient ways of providing treatments. And one of the big successes of the NHS over the last decade has been to find hospital procedures that could be done as day cases, whereas in the past they might have been in hospital for 2 or 3 days.
What about the kind of things that businesses do when they haven't got much money, like, I don't know, paying your suppliers later or not recruiting people to replace the people that have gone?
The NHS is very much in that ball game now as well, with hospitals running around about a £4 billion deficit a year. The only way that's being managed is precisely by putting off paying invoices, competing final demands. Which one is the most important? Which one genuinely is going to stop delivering my clinical supplies next week if I don't pay this? The government actually has a 30-day invoice target, because you know, what you don't want to be doing is destabilising your local economy because, for example, you're not paying your catering supplier. That could genuinely put people out of jobs in your local area, and you know, this has a sort of snowballing effect.
Is it your view that what we would need to do in order to try and resolve these problems is an increase of about 4% increase in real terms each year?
4% real terms increase is actually what the NHS has received since its inception. Our analysis, which is shared by a number of other independent experts, has found that given the growth in population, given demographic changes, most notably, you know, that we are getting older as a nation, a 4% real terms increase is what's needed. And that also, by the way, takes into account the NHS becoming more efficient every year.
Roughly how much is that in actual money?
That's around £7 billion extra cash next year.
OK. Now, what do you think of the idea that you've heard that one of the possible ways in which we can get public agreement to fund this is by hypothecated tax? In other words, we simply say a certain percentage of our tax will always go towards the National Health Service, and that allows parties to say, yes, we are putting your tax up, but it's for this.
Well, the main problem with tying NHS funding to a certain percentage of taxation or even a certain percentage of gross national product is that that figure can go down as well as up. So that's one of our main objections to it. I mean, obviously, there are various fixes you could come to sort of safeguard against that scenario, where you just then reintroduce the whole argument again. So tying health spending to some sort of earmarking element of tax is really just politicians trying to avoid having the real discussion. And it seems that actually, you know, Joe Public doesn't actually need any persuading that we should be spending more on health.
If we carry on exactly the way we are now, at what point do you think we get to a stage whereby we say this is actually not a service that we're particularly happy or proud of?
Well, I think that is one of the big dangers. So at the moment, with growing waiting lists, what I would expect to find is that the middle classes and the better off will increasingly be able to opt out. You know, why wait 3 or 4 months for your operation when you can just go to the private sector? And so then we'll end up with two tiers of health system in the UK. We'll have the NHS, which will be for the poor, you know, effectively just a safety net service. But the risk there is we lose the social contract, the agreement which at the moment still stands, that we have been happy since 1948 to contribute 4% real terms each year. The aberration is not 4% real terms each year. The aberration is what's been happening for the last 7 years.
Chris, it seems a good point to bring you in to talk about the relationship between the National Health Service and the Treasury.
The two big things for the Treasury are, first of all, that fundamentally there's basically one buyer of health products in this country. And if you flood a load of cash into the NHS, particularly if you do it quickly, there is quite good historical evidence about how basically suppliers just whack up their prices and you'll end up buying the same stuff at just a higher price. So they have got a reasonable reason to be worried about putting a lot of money in very fast. There's a second thing, which is that they worry that hospital leaders don't fundamentally believe that the Treasury isn't secretly preparing a bailout continuously. And they know that, particularly at moments like now, if you're a hospital leader running a deficit, you're not going to get fired for just running a deficit. And that's a really bad state of affairs for the Treasury, because they really need hospital leaders to really believe that if things go wrong, their neck is on the line, because they need those hospitals to run within their means. So there is a sort of moral hazard problem the Treasury is continually facing. The thing is, we are kind of through the looking glass at the moment, because there's no one who seriously believes that the NHS can seriously meet anything like the mandate we give it, you know, treating patients for A&E within 4 hours of them turning up, seeing consultants in 18 weeks of being referred at the moment on this current budget. So if you're to be really brutally cynical about this, the Treasury can look on the last few years as having successfully explained to hospitals that they are willing to accept a lower level of service and not put more money in. And they've made that point. So if you're a hospital leader and you genuinely think, oh, it doesn't matter if we're running a deficit now, don't worry, the cavalry's coming, I think they've probably disabused you of that notion in the last few years. The question is, at what point the Treasury is going to say, actually, guys, this is just too low. We've made our point. This is too poor a service. We have to start putting the cash back in. Back when the Tories were in opposition, Philip Hammond, when he was Shadow Chief Secretary, used to complain continuously, why can't the public sector, particularly the NHS, mount the sorts of productivity gains that the private sector does all the time? Since 2010, the public sector is the one that's been doing all the productivity gaining, and the private sector is the one that stagnated. The Treasury's approach has had the effect that it wanted in driving enormous productivity gains in the NHS. The problem they've got is they're not coming fast enough, because it is basically not possible for them to come fast enough.
Quite a few people, and you notice these things when they begin to kind of seep out of newspaper columns and into politician speeches and so on the fringes, let's test this out, is coming back to the idea of the hypothecated tax. In other words, we say, we're going to put your taxes up, but the bit of taxes that we're going to put up is going to go to the National Health Service, because we know you love it and we know you want it. Now, what do you reckon to that?
So the problem with hypothecated taxes is obviously that there's no guarantee that the amount of money, the thing you're giving the hypothecated tax to, is going to match the amount of money that's coming in from the hypothecated tax. And the classic example of this is road tax. There are lots of people who believe their road taxes are only spent on roads, and they get angry at cyclists, for example, who don't pay road tax. And there is danger in deceiving the public about saying, we're going to put a penny on this or a penny on that, and the money's going to go to the NHS. If, in practice, what you really mean is, we're going to increase taxes by about 10 billion and we're going to spend that 10 billion right now on this other thing. And to draw a harder connection than that is a little bit dangerous and potentially corrosive in public trust. If in practice, if that tax yield falls in the future or it comes in underweight to begin with, you're not going to pass that loss on to the institution of the other side.
So hypothecation is just a bit of a wheeze.
If you can be clear with the public, we're raising taxes by 10 billion this year. We are increasing spending on the following things by 10 billion. That's fine. Don't pretend that it's a sort of hard hypothecation. And then you do away with a lot of problems. That's the sort of, it's not an insuperable problem. The problem for the Treasury is hard hypothecation. It's creating sort of weird rules that say you can only spend this amount of money on this sort of thing. That can lead to very peculiar, perverse consequences. The current boundaries of what the NHS actually does are basically the same ones that Nye Bevan resigned over. So we still charge a bit for prescriptions. We charge for eyeglasses. We charge for dental care. But we are currently having a conversation about whether it's acceptable for hospitals to charge for their car parks. Like, our sense of the idea that there are things the NHS shouldn't do or that it should be able to charge for hasn't really moved in 60 years. So it might be the case. I mean, in 100 years' time, the sea might have risen 50 feet, and yet we will still be arguing about whether it's acceptable to charge for aspirin in Bradford pharmacies.
Thanks. My summing up on this is grimly simple. We want a health service that requires us, almost all of us, to pay more towards it, and there are no easy outs. My thanks to my guests, Dan Wellings, Anita Charlesworth, Sir Julian Legrand, Sally Gainsbury and Chris Cook. And until next week, goodbye. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Serena Tarling. And please let us know what you think about this programme or indeed the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments.